Hi, Dave Emery here. This is For the Record program number 988. Hindutva Fascism, Part 1. The Assassination of Mahatma Gandhi, Part 1. This is being recorded on December 12th of the year 2017. I had intended to continue with analysis of domestic fascists' use of cyber media, Breitbart and YouTube and other things to promote fascist slash white supremacist, or what is being lumped in as, quote, alt-right, unquote, ideology. We have covered that quite a bit, and I think the programs For the Record 986 and 987, the last two programs recorded, when dovetailed with some of our discussion of Facebook, Breitbart, Cambridge Analytica, the formidable financial and tech empire of Robert Mercer, and the psychological warfare parent company of Cambridge Analytica, that should be dovetailed with For the Record 986 and 987. I think, however, for a number of reasons, I'm going to go ahead and begin doing a series that I have intended to do for some time. We have spoken in the past about the RSS and the BJP in India. RSS is a Hindutva or Hindu nationalist fascist organization, one of whose members assassinated Mahatma Gandhi in a conspiracy that we will talk about in this and probably our next program as well. I think the full coverage of this will take more time than we really have to have allotted to us in the 1 hour for this program. I think, too, the fact that India is the second most populous country on Earth and the third largest country geographically, I believe, behind Russia and China. India is the largest country on Earth in terms of area. And when you have a country that is not only that large and that populous, but that enjoys such a prominent position on the Earth Island or World Island, the stretch of land running from the Straits of Gibraltar all the way across Europe and Asia to the Pacific Ocean, I think having a country that large and that populous under the direction of a form of fascist political party, and the BJP is simply a cat's paw for the RSS, which is a Hindu nationalist or Hindutva, H-I-N-D-U-T-V-A, fascist party. I think that is something that warrants attention. We have spoken about the RSS and the BJP in a number of contexts, bridging the discussion from Breitbart and Steve Bannon. Steve Bannon was a big fan of the BJP and Narendra Modi, whom he referred to as the Ronald Reagan of India. Many of Donald Trump's business contacts in India are associated with the BJP. The rise of Narendra Modi in India was financed in part by Pierre Omidyar of eBay, who also helped to finance the rise of the OUNB successor organizations in Ukraine. Pierre Omidyar is now associated with the National Endowment for Democracy and the Agency for International Development. He is, of course, to so-called progressives, the best known for helping to finance the journalistic efforts of Glenn Greenwald et al. With The Intercept and First Look Media. He helped to finance Narendra Modi's lies in India. Also, someone who is heavily networked with Narendra Modi and who helped to arrange the details of his American trip is a Democratic representative from Hawaii named Tulsi Gabbard. Tulsi Gabbard introduced Bernie Sanders' name on the floor of the Democratic Convention, nominated him on the floor of the Democratic Convention, and was being kicked around as the possible or probable vice presidential candidate for Bernie Sanders had he managed to get the Democratic nomination. Tulsi Gabbard is also, was networking heavily with the RSS in her trip, or on her trip to India. We will talk more about Gabbard and the Hare Krishna cult, which is yet another manifestation of, or permutation of not only Hindutva fascism, but also probably of a fascist mind control cult. That, however, will be later in our series. One of the main reasons, however, that I felt it would be appropriate to talk about the assassination of Gandhi concerns not only the very dark political times in which we are living, and I really could not be more pessimistic, but the fact that Gandhi's satyagraha, or truth force, as he called it, really, I think, not only offers a viable blueprint for not only speaking truth to power, but most importantly for implementing the political ramifications of truth to power, perhaps the only way for people who lack military prowess and great wealth to successfully implement their political will on those who are wealthier, more powerful, and more violent. Mohandas K. Gandhi, or Mahatma, meaning great soul, of course, was the nationalist leader in India who, without resorting to violence and without firing a shot, helped to win the freedom of India, Britain's largest colony. He was frustrated in many ways because he sought to have both Hindus and Muslims remain as part of a united India, and he felt that the Muslim minority in India, very sizable, should enjoy equal and unbiased political and social rights and religious rights in India. However, the British helped to maintain their political control of their colony by deliberately promoting strife between Hindus and Muslims. There were Muslim leaders and, perhaps most importantly, Hindu leaders, including a person we will talk about at length in this broadcast and our next, a fellow named V, as in Victor, D, as in David, Savarkar, Savarkar. He was the founder of the primary ideological driving force behind the RSS, again, the Hindutva fascist organization that is the foundation of the BJP in India. Gandhi originated, or certainly employed, a political methodology that was really comprised militant nonviolence. It is well beyond the scope of this program and the next to do justice or even really to go into Gandhi's relatively complex philosophy. I would emphatically recommend that listeners to this program not only purchase the book that will be the foundation of this program, a wonderful and very small book called Gandhi and the Unspeakable, subtitled His Final Experiment with Truth. This was authored by James W. Douglas, D-O-U-G-L-A-S-S, who was also the author of JFK and the Unspeakable, Why He Died and Why It Mattered, one of the best books about the JFK assassination and one that we have used on a number of occasions in the past. I should stress that neither myself nor any of the stations that carry this program get any money from this. I think as I am speaking on December 12th at the, not the dawning, but as we are proceeding into the holiday gift-giving season, Gandhi and the Unspeakable would make a wonderful holiday gift. It is very small, only 100-plus pages, and it is not a difficult read. It is not expensive, and yet it is well worth the investment of the money it would take to order the book and the time it takes to read it. Beyond that, we are going to be talking about the political circumstances of Gandhi's assassination in this and, in all probability, our next program as well. And we will not have time to go into some of the most important aspects of the book, which are Gandhi's political slash religious philosophy, because his political philosophy and political methodology was inextricably linked with his religious slash spiritual philosophy. I think that with the darkness that is overtaking the world, and with an awful lot of people who are frankly going off the rails, I think that in this holiday season, when many people pause to ostensibly at least give lip service to matters religious or spiritual, I think that undertaking a serious examination of Gandhi's political slash spiritual philosophy and methodology, and beyond that, to an extent that one can do it, implementing that spiritual slash religious slash political methodology and philosophy would be as good a thing as one could do under the circumstances. I think that I would also recommend that in addition to purchasing either for yourself and or for those close to you this wonderful, very short, and very important book, again, Gandhi and the Unspeakable by James W. Douglas. There will be a link in the written description for this show to a place where you can buy it, aside from the huge company that is named for a Latin American river. I think that one could do no better in this holiday season than to get Gandhi and the Unspeakable and read it and or purchase it for people close to you so that they can read it as well. I would dovetail that with the purchasing, giving, reading of a longer and more complex work, and that is called Gandhi's Truth on the Origins of Militant Nonviolence, that was authored by the late, very great psychoanalytical writer and thinker, Erik Erikson, E-R-I-K-E-R-I-K-S-O-N. That book was published in, I think, 1968, maybe 1969, and was dedicated to Martin Luther King. And I think in terms of understanding Gandhi's methodology, I think Erik Erikson's Gandhi's Truth will not only give you a much deeper and more complex understanding of the methodology and the psychology and the spiritual inspiration for Gandhi's political methodology. I think it would, again, I think that would dovetail beautifully with Gandhi and the Unspeakable. The Eric Erickson volume is not nearly as accessible or short as Gandhi and the Unspeakable, but I think they will go superbly together. So that is my recommendation. And again, as we are in the holiday season, I think one could do no better than to purchase and read and actualize the insights in Gandhi and the Unspeakable by James W. Douglas, and perhaps to give copies of that. Again, it's a very short and inexpensive book. Give copies of that to those whom you value and who you think would value that book. And again, just for FCC purposes, I get no money whatsoever from this program or from promoting Gandhi and the Unspeakable. It is simply an excellent book and a very valuable book, an important book in this time. And again, it is something of a successor volume to James W. Douglas's book on the JFK assassination called JFK and the Unspeakable.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. Long article-length descriptions of the For the Record programs are available at spitfirelist.com, also featuring information that wasn't in the original program due to the limitations of time.
We are going to be talking about a number of things in this program and the next. It is amazing, and I think that is why James Douglas titled his book in the way that he did, how many similarities there are between the assassination of Gandhi and the assassination of JFK. Gandhi's assassination was the result of a conspiracy. At the core of the conspiracy was the RSS and an overlapping organization called the Hindu Mahasabha. That's Mahasabha. That was a paramilitary organization that was associated with the RSS. And both the RSS and the Hindu Mahasabha had deeply infiltrated the Indian security forces and also had profound influence within the newly independent Indian government. The security forces in India, and as we will see, elements of the judicial establishment in India, and some of the top political leaders in India, including Prime Minister Nehru and Mr. Patel, who were disciples of Gandhi, also bear a measure of responsibility for not implementing the security that Gandhi needed. And lurking at the foundation of this very tragic phenomenon is the fact that so many of the people, including Patel and Nehru, who revered Gandhi and who wept at his murder, they were terrified in the end of the power of retribution that could be exacted by the RSS and the Hindu Mahasabha, which again had deeply infiltrated the Indian security services. And beyond that, if in fact Savarkar, the primary force in the RSS, had been convicted for his role in the assassination of Gandhi, and he was deeply involved, it might have touched off even deeper social chaos in India between Hindus and Muslims. Again, I think the parallels between the assassination of JFK, in which a great many people knew full well what had happened, but were frightened of what might happen to them, and beyond that, were frightened about the implications for the U.S. position in the world if it became known that JFK had been killed as the result of a powerful conspiracy by many of the most powerful national security elements in the country. They were frightened about what that would tell people about the U.S. And for that reason, they remained silent, and that silence simply led to more bloodshed and more chaos. I think as certainly as one looks around at what is going on, it is very easy to be afraid, and I would counsel perhaps coming to understand Gandhi's political philosophy rooted, again, in a spiritual outlook and a very disciplined, introspective, personal cleansing or catharsis that he felt was essential as part of the development of a proper, militant, nonviolent attitude. I think one could do no better than that, and that is why in this holiday season I am undertaking our examination of Hindutva fascism. So let us proceed with our analysis of Gandhi's killing and the circumstances around that and what came out of that. I am quite sure that this will require a second program as well. And again, all of the material that you are going to be hearing comes from the book Gandhi and the Unspeakable by James W. Douglas, copyright 2012, published in hardcover by Orbis Books, O-R-B-I-S. I can't recommend strongly enough that people get this book for themselves and use it as a holiday present for those whom you think would use it and value it. Or if you hear this program or read the description after the holidays, I think that, well, certainly it would make a very good purchase for yourself and a very good gift as well. So let us proceed with Gandhi and the Unspeakable by James W. Douglas. Now, V.D. Savarkar had been one of a number of revolutionaries in the British colony of India, and he was imprisoned for his activism at the Port Blair, B-L-A-I-R, prison. However, in that prison, he came to believe that it was in the best interests of India's Hindu population and India to actually form an alliance with Britain, whom he saw as a fellow Aryan nation, and he felt just exactly so. In some of our discussions with Peter Lavenda and in some of our other programs over the decades about, I guess one could say, esoteric fascism or esoteric Nazism, the affinity that the SS and some other fascist groups had for India, whom they saw as the genesis of the Aryan race, is something that looms very large here, because again, Savarkar, V.D. Savarkar, Victor David Savarkar, V period D period S-A-V-A-R-K-A-R, came to believe that it was best for India to align itself with Britain into an Aryan empire. James Douglas rather writes, during his solitary confinement at Port Blair, Savarkar's ideology turned away from rebellion against the empire. In September of 1914, he wrote a letter to the British government in India expressing his hope for an Indo-British alliance based on a shared racial background that would transform the British Empire into the Aryan Empire. He wrote that he and other revolutionary leaders were now ready and willing to be friends of the British Empire if it equipped India with a form of government vital for her freedom. And next, we're going to take a look at how the RSS, the Rashtriya Swayamsevak Sangh, R-A-S-H-T-R-I-Y-A, SWAYAMSEVAKSANGH, three words, abbreviated RSS, coalesced around on the foundation of Savarkar's philosophy. It was actually midwifed by a physician named K. B. Hedgewar, or Hedgewar, H-E-D-G-E-W-A-R. And by the way, I am absolutely confident that I am going to butcher the vast majority of the pronunciations of these words or names here. So bear with me. I will, wherever feasible, I will spell them out. They will be in the written description for the record 988, and in all probability, for the record 989 as well. So, as they say, don't shoot the piano player. He's doing the best he can, and I have no doubt that I am mispronouncing these names.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. You can subscribe to the comments posted on the SpitfireList.com website, most of them by a brilliant contributing editor who uses the moniker Terra Fractal, specializing, but by no means exclusively, in economic and financial matters.
Now, of the formal coalescence of the RSS, the Hindutva fascist organization whose political front is the BJP of current Indian Prime Minister BJP, of its coalescence in 1925 on the foundation of the political philosophy of V.D. Savarkar, we read from Gandhi and the Unspeakable. One of Savarkar's early visitors in Ratnagiri in March of 1925 was K.B. Hedgewar, H-E-D-G-E-W-A-R, a medical practitioner inspired by Savarkar's recently published Hindutva, What is a Hindu? Hedgewar consulted with Savarkar on how to implement his Hindu nationalist vision. Following their discussion, Hedgewar founded the Rashtriya Swayamsevak Sangh, or RSS, the Organization of National Volunteers, whose innocuous name covered an organization that consciously copied the strategy of Mussolini's fascist black shirts. The RSS would become infamous by terrorizing Muslims to gain political power in India at the end of the 20th century. Just a brief note, one of the most common characteristics of various kinds of fascism is the demonization of a group of, quote, others, unquote. And lurking at the foundation of that philosophy is a corporatist or laissez-faire or what is now called neoliberal economic philosophy. That is one of the reasons why Pierre Omidyar, for example, sought the elevation of Narendra Modi and his BJP, which is a political cat's paw for the RSS. However, just as, for example, the German National Socialist Workers' Party or Nazi Party demonized Jews and Slavs and Gypsies and Blacks, the RSS demonized Muslims. The Islamic fascist organization, the Muslim Brotherhood, demonizes Christians, Jews, and in Asia they demonize Hindus as well. But the pointing of the finger at the demonized other, those people, they are the problem. Do something about them. Maybe denying their rights, or beat the fresh fertilizer out of them, or kill them, or whatever. That is the prescription, because the problem is those people. They are the problem. And in the case of Hindutva, or Hindu nationalist fascism, the demonized other are Muslims. This last couple of sentences again. Hedgewar consulted with Savarkar on how to implement his Hindu nationalist vision. Following their discussion, Hedgewar founded the Rashtriya Swayamsevak Sangh, or RSS, the Organization of National Volunteers, whose innocuous name covered an organization that consciously copied the strategy of Mussolini's fascist black shirts. The RSS would become infamous by terrorizing Muslims to gain political power in India at the end of the 20th century. And what we're going to look at next is how Nathuram, N-A-T-H-U-R-A-M, Godse, G-O-D-S-E, became the personal secretary to V.D. Savarkar, and how he also became the head of the academic department of one of the branches of the RSS. Nathuram Godse, again, the personal secretary to V.D. Savarkar, was the man who shot Mahatma Gandhi to death. Returning again to Gandhi and the unspeakable. In 1929, Vinayak Godse, G-O-D-S-E, a postal worker, was transferred to Ratnagiri. 3 weeks after the Godse family's arrival in town, Vinayak's, that's V-I-M-A-Y-A-K's, 19-year-old son, Nathuram, N-A-T-H-U-R-A-M, visited Savarkar for the first time. As Nathuram's younger brother and co-conspirator in Gandhi's murder, Gopal, G-O-P-A-L, has written, Nathuram then, quote, went to Savarkar often. Nathuram gladly undertook the work of copying the writings of Veer, V-E-E-R, meaning brave, Savarkar. Impressed by Nathuram's devotion, Savarkar appointed him as his secretary. Nathuram also joined the RSS, eventually heading the academic department of one of its branches. Nathuram Godse had discovered his lifelong vocation, following, promoting, and carrying out Savarkar's teaching. And again, Nathuram Godse was the assassin of Mahatma Gandhi and was hung for his role, as we will see as we go through the chronicle of the events and analysis of the events. He was acting at the behest of Savarkar, and yet he also took steps to shield Savarkar after his arrest, and Savarkar basically let him twist slowly in the wind. Now, one of the organizations which, along with the RSS, infiltrated the Indian government, and in particular, the Indian security services, meaning the police, the constabulary, and the military, was something called the Hindu Mahasabha. That's H-I-N-D-U, of course, and then Mahasabha is M-A-H-A-S-A-B-H-A. This organization was founded by Savarkar in the 1930s. It became a very important organization recruiting Hindu youth to join the British armed forces in the Second World War so that they would acquire military training. And it became, again, a primary force along with the closely allied or inextricably allied RSS within the Indian security apparatus. And that is fundamental to an understanding of the dynamic behind Gandhi's assassination. Returning to Gandhi and the Unspeakable by James Douglas. In the 1930s, Savarkar helped create the anti-Muslim, military-oriented Hindu Mahasabha organization. He was Mahasabha president from 1937 through 1944. When the Second World War began, Savarkar urged Hindu youth to join the British-led armed forces so they could be, quote, reborn into a martial race. His 1940s slogan wed Hindu nationalism with the British war effort, quote, Hinduize all politics and militarize Hindudom. Last couple of sentences, or last few again, because again, the Mahasabha is fundamental to an understanding of the dynamics underlying Gandhi's assassination. Speaking of Savarkar and the anti-Muslim, Hindu-oriented, military-oriented Mahasabha, Savarkar was Mahasabha president from 1937 through 1944. When the Second World War began, Savarkar urged Hindu youths to join the British-led armed forces so they could be, quote, reborn into a martial race. His 1940s slogan went Hindu nationalism with the war effort. Hinduize all politics and militarize Hindudom, unquote. And the Hindu Mahasabha, along with the RSS, then heavily infiltrated the national security apparatus and the political infrastructure of the fledgling Indian government after World War II, and that was one of the central features of the successful implementation of the assassination plot against Gandhi and its cover-up throughout many levels of the Indian government. Returning again to Gandhi and the Unspeakable by James Douglas. Having become, in January of 1948, the Muslims' defender in Delhi, India's Hindu-dominated capital, Gandhi was in deepening danger. The Hindu right had allied itself with elements of Gandhi's own Congress Party. Savarkar's followers held cabinet and administrative positions in the government. Hindu Mahasabha and RSS extremists had also infiltrated India's security forces. Key police officials were more committed to an exclusively Hindu nation than they were to Gandhi's democratic ideal of a diverse secular union. They could not be counted on to protect the life of a presumably pro-Muslim Satyagrahi when he was attacked by forces the police sympathized with. The state police provided the context of Gandhi's murder. Now, in coming to understand not only the successful realization of the RSS, Savarkar, Hindu Mahasabha, Nataram Godse assassination plot against Gandhi, it is important to understand that there was an earlier plot. Gandhi was killed on January 30th of 1948. There was another plot that was to kill Gandhi, and also one of the Indian Muslim leaders about whom we will have more to say later. That, however, was the plot actually did take place, but Gandhi himself was not killed. That took place on January 20th of 1948, a full 10 days before Gandhi was actually killed. And as we are going to see, some of the participants in this plot actually rolled over after their arrest and clued the Indian authorities into what was going to take place. And yet, the Indian authorities, again with the RSS and the Hindu Mahasabha, having infiltrated not only the Indian security services, but also the Indian political infrastructure, and with some of the leadership being openly frightened of the consequences of sentencing Savarkar to death, and he was the mastermind of the assassination plot against Gandhi, they covered it up. So again, the January 20th unsuccessful assassination plot against Gandhi is fundamental for our understanding of how the cover-up actually took place. Now, what was to happen here was that a bomb was to have been detonated. It was actually detonated. And then the conspirators were to not only shoot at Gandhi with handguns, but to hurl hand grenades at him to make sure he was dead. So of the January 20th, 1948 unsuccessful plot against Gandhi, we read in Gandhi and the Unspeakable by James Douglas, 2 days before he announced his Delhi fast, Godse and Apte had already ordered the arsenal they would use for their assassination plot. On January 10th, they placed the order with Digambar Bhaj, B-A-D-G-E, an arms salesman in Pune. They told Bhaj to have the necessary explosives, revolvers, and hand grenades delivered to them by January 14th at the Hindu Mahasabha office in Bombay. Savarkar himself had moved to Bombay, where the assassins would seek their mentor's final instructions and blessing. On the night of January 12th, when Godse and Apte APTE read the announcement of Gandhi's fast from their teleprinter, they set January 20th as their target date for murdering the Mahatma. And one of the conspirators here is a fellow named Madan Lawa, M-A-D-A-N-L-A-L-A, Pahwa, P-A-H-W-A. As we will see, he eventually rolled over on the conspiracy. And that is one of the most important factors in understanding the assassination of Gandhi. The authorities had been alerted as to what was going to happen, and they did nothing. Returning again to Gandhi and the Unspeakable. On the morning of January 20th, Apte APTE Bhaj, B-A-D-G-E, and Bhaj's servant Shankar, S-H-A-N-K-A-R, went to Birla House, B-I-R-L-A, as a scouting party for the assassination attempt late that afternoon. On the grounds, Apte suddenly indicated to Bhaj, quote, a stoutish gentleman dressed up in a black suit, unquote, whom they spotted walking out of a building. This is that Suwarardi, that's S-U-H-R-A-W-A-R-D-Y. Mr. Suwarardi was a Muslim leader who initially was opposed to Gandhi, but who came to become a very important political ally of Gandhi, because he too, like Gandhi, felt that both Hindus and Muslims must find common political ground, and that the fledgling Indian nation should be a unified one with equal rights for both Hindus and Muslims. In our next program, we're going to take a look at what happened. Suwarardi, S-U-H-R-A-W-A-R-D-Y, was not killed in this assassination attempt. However, he became, for a time, Prime Minister of Pakistan after the partition of India into the Muslim Pakistan and primarily Hindu India. And eventually he became a dissident and died under very strange circumstances. He was, in all probability, murdered by the Pakistani authorities. That, however, is later. So once again, of the January 20th, 1948 plot, on the morning of January 20th, Apte APTE Bhaj and Bhaj's servant Shankar went to Birla House as a scouting party for the assassination attempt late that afternoon. On the grounds, Apte suddenly indicated to Bhaj a stoutish gentleman dressed up in a black suit whom they spotted walking out of a building. This is that Suwarardi, Apte whispered, identifying one of their targets. As Bhaj testified in the murder trial, Apte, repeating Savarkar, said that so far as possible, both Gandhi, and Suwarardi should be finished, unquote. He further said that if it was not possible to finish, i.e. kill, both of them, then at least one of them must be finished. The three men surveyed the prayer ground and the back access to the servants' quarters, where, through the trellis of a ventilator, one unseen assassin could shoot a praying Gandhi from only 4 or 5 steps behind him, while another could throw a hand grenade blowing up Gandhi and anyone who was near him at the time. In the afternoon, the seven conspirators met in a room of the Marina Hotel in Delhi. After accepting suggestions from Bhaj and Karkare, K-A-R-K-A-R-E, up they finalized their instructions to murder Gandhi and his companions at his prayer meeting. Mother-in-law Pawa, again, M-A-D-A-N-L-A-L, Pawa, P-A-H-W-A, was to explode a gun cotton bomb on the rear wall to panic the crowd. As soon as the bomb went off and the confusion erupted, Badge, again the arms dealer, and Shankar would shoot Gandhi from the servants' quarters, shielded by the ventilator. Each of them would also throw a hand grenade at Gandhi. Update told Gopal Godse, Natarajan's younger brother, as well as Pawa and Karkare, to throw their remaining hand grenades on Gandhi at the time. Thus, even if the two shooters failed to kill Gandhi, five assassins would be hurling hand grenades at him, and hopefully Suhrawardi beside him. Badge, however, had developed cold feet. He went inside and wrapped his and Shankar's revolvers in a towel along with their two hand grenades. He put the towel with its incriminating contents in a handbag. He stowed the handbag under the back seat of a waiting taxi. Then he rejoined Apte and Godse and went into the meeting, keeping his hands in his side pockets as if he were still carrying his weapons. And as we will see, with Badge, the weapons dealer who actually acquired the guns, explosives, and hand grenades for the plot after he got cold feet and backed out of it, although pretending he was still part of it, the plot was unsuccessful. Returning to Gandhi and the Unspeakable. And again, this is on January 20th, 1948, 10 days before Gandhi was killed. From the audience, Apte then signaled Pawa to begin the assassination scenario. The young man obediently ignited the fuse for the gun cotton charge in the back wall. As the fuse burned down to the charge, Gandhi was drawing a parallel between the treatment of minorities in America and in India. In America, Negroes are still treated cruelly as if they were slaves, and yet the Americans indulge in tall talk about social equality. They do not realize the injustice of their actions. We assume we are better people than they and cannot do such things, and yet think of what happens here, unquote. A deafening explosion suddenly shook the prayer ground. A large chunk of the back wall collapsed. Smoke and dust rose in the air. The two Godses, Apte and Karkare, waited anxiously for Badge and Shankar to launch their attack on Gandhi. Gandhi raised his hand. He gestured to the crowd to calm down. The people returned to their places. The secretly disarmed Badge and Shankar did nothing. Witnesses pointed out Madanlal Pawa to the police, and while Pawa was being arrested, all six of his co-conspirators melted into the crowd and escaped. Madanlal Pawa was interrogated initially at Birla House. In response to the police's questions, he gave only one answer, that he exploded the bomb, quote, because I did not like Gandhiji's policy of maintaining peace and friendship, unquote. Gandhi was under no illusion that Pawa's arrest meant the threat was over. When he was told by a co-worker that he had said that the explosion at the prayer meeting might turn out to have been nothing but a harmless prank, Gandhi laughed at the thought. He exclaimed, quote, the fool, don't you see there is a terrible and widespread conspiracy behind it, unquote. While his co-workers went about their business, Gandhi prepared to meet his death. And next, we're going to take a look at how the investigating authorities came to learn of the fact that Savarkar and the RSS were behind the plot, and that the conspirators would come again, returning again to Gandhi and the unspeakable. Nathuram Godse and Narayan Apte retreated to Bombay, where they succeeded in reuniting with their closest cohort, Vishnu, V-I-S-H-N-U, Karkare, K-A-R-K-A-R-E. In the meantime, those whom Godse and Apte had left in charge of their newspaper, the Hindu Rashtra, reported the assassination attempt as the work of anti-Gandhi refugees. By the way, the Hindu Rashtra was a Hindutva newspaper that was edited by Nathuram Godse, the personal secretary to Savarkar and a member of the RSS. It was Nathuram Godse who eventually killed Mahatma Gandhi. These last couple of sentences again. In the meantime, those whom Godse and Apte had left in charge of their newspaper, the Hindu Rashtra, R-A-S-H-T-R-A, reported the assassination attempt as the work of anti-Gandhi refugees. Hindu Rashtra's headline proclaimed, quote, "Representative reaction shown by enraged Hindu refugees against the appeasement policy of Gandhiji." Fixing the blame for the murder attempt, or from the standpoint of Gandhi's enemies, the credit on refugees was easy. The only conspirator seized by the police was Madanlal Pahwa, or Pahwa, P-A-H-W-A. At the Delhi police station, Pahwa soon confessed the entire plot to his interrogators. He named for the police one of the conspirators whom he called Kirkri, quote, K-I-R-K-R-E-E, unquote, his mentor, Karkare, K-A-R-K-A-R-E. In describing each of his six companions, Pahwa said one of them was a definitive identification of Nathuram Godse, whom he knew under the pseudonym Deshpande, D-E-S-H-P-A-N-D-E. Pahwa led the police to the room in the Marina Hotel where Godse and Apte, who were registered under S. and N. Deshpande, unquote, had held their final planning meeting with the others. When the police searched the room, they found in a drawer a typed press release for a Hindu Mahasabha leader, Ashutosh Lahiri, that's A-S-H-U-T-O-S-H, Lahiri, L-A-H-I-R-I, that repudiated, quote, his organizations having signed the 9-point pledge required by Gandhiji, unquote. The press release said the Hindu Mahasabha was, quote, opposed to the basic policy of Mahatma Gandhi and his followers in regard to the treatment meted out to Muslim minorities in India, unquote. Here was an important clue that Pahwa's co-conspirators were linked with the Hindu Mahasabha. Long did that the rooms occupants had given the hotel for washing included three items bearing the initials N-V-G, standing for Nathuram Vinayak Godse, N-A-T-H-U-R-A-M, V-I-N-A-Y-A-K, Godse, G-O-D-S-E. The importance of all this evidence identifying Gandhi's would-be assassins would be underlined by a chilling statement Madanlal Pahwa made to the police. They will come again. Nathuram Godse, in the company of Apte and Karkare, would fulfill Pahwa's prophecy to the police by shooting Gandhi to death on January 30th, 10 days later. Last couple of sentences again. The importance of all this evidence identifying Gandhi's would-be assassins was underlined by a chilling statement Madanlal Pahwa made to the police. They will come again, unquote. Nathuram Godse, in the company of Apte and Karkare, would fulfill Pahwa's prophecy to the police by shooting Gandhi to death on January 30th. How was that to happen? Incriminating, identifying information was in the hands of the police. Pahwa was warning that the killers would return and try again. Moreover, mother-in-law Power had already divulged the plot to kill Gandhi the week before the conspirators even tried to carry it out. He told his employer in Bombay, Professor J. C. Jain, J-A-I-N, about his upcoming role throwing a bomb, unquote, as a diversion at Gandhi's prayer meeting so that his associates could kill Gandhi. Jain thought Powell was just making up the story until he was shocked to read a January 21st newspaper article about Powell's arrest for the bombing incident. Jain then managed to meet with B. G. Kher, K-H-E-R, Premier of the province of Bombay, and Morarji Desai, that's M-O-R-A-R-J-I, Desai, D-E-S-A-I, Home Minister of the province of Bombay. He had succeeded in gaining the attention of the two most important government officials in Bombay on the urgent matter of Gandhi's impending assassination over a week before it would happen. Jain informed the government leaders that he knew from Power that the bombing was part of what, quote, appeared to be a big conspiracy, unquote, to kill Gandhi. Madanlal had told me that the conspirators had formed a party which was financed by one Karkari from Ahmednagar, A-H-M-E-D-N-A-J-A-R, unquote, who had visited him along with Power. A further connection was Savarkar, who Power had said had met with him for 2 hours, raising the young Hindu refugee for exploits such as his attempt to dynamite the house of a Muslim. On hearing Jane's story, Home Minister Desai had, he said later, a strong feeling, beginning again, on hearing Jane's story, Home Minister Desai had, he said, quote, later, a strong feeling that Savarkar was behind the conspiracy, unquote. Desai said he pressed on Jane's information that he, begin again, Desai said he passed on Jane's information that night to his deputy police commissioner, J.D. Nagarwala, ordering him first, quote, to arrest Karkare, unquote. Karkare had an outstanding warrant for his arrest in another case but had not yet been found. Second, quote, to keep a close watch on Savarkar's house and his movements, unquote. And third, to find out as to who were the persons involved in the plot, unquote. Desai said he also shared Jane's information on the plot the next day, January 22, 1948, in Ahmedabad with the Indian Union Government's Home Minister, Vallabhbhai Patel, who is in charge of the national government's security apparatus. That's V-A-L-L-A-B-H-B-H-A-I Patel, in charge of the national government's security apparatus. This was shared with him on January 22nd of 1948, 8 days before Gandhi was killed. And Patel really did effectively nothing. He was one of Gandhi's closest followers. We're going to continue with our analysis of the assassination of Mahatma Gandhi in our next program. However, this concludes For the Record program number 988, Hindutva Fascism, Part 1, The Assassination of Mahatma Gandhi, Part 1. This is being recorded on December 12th of the year 2017. I'm Dave Emery. Have fun.